Hi. As the name of the podcast suggests, I connect a lot of topics together in the service of growing the practice of psychotherapy. As the number of episodes grows, it occurred to me that I could offer you a way to organize the episodes. So I've created playlists. Playlists are compilations of all the episodes on one topic. If you'd like to try this out, there is a link in the show notes to the playlist page, where you will find the categories, and then you click on the category you're interested in, and you'll see all the episodes on that topic. I hope you enjoy it. While you're there, you could sign up for the newsletter if you like. Those come out weekly and are a great way for us to stay in touch, and for you to keep up to date about the podcast and additional events. Hello, and thank you for joining the Connection Therapy Podcast. This is a podcast about the craft of psychotherapy, and we seek to support those who strive to improve their craft by sharing research about the science and stories about the art of psychology. Together, we will explore these findings so you can decide how you want to apply them to benefit your practice. Thank you for returning to learn more about the research study I did. As I mentioned in the earlier episodes, this study that I completed for my dissertation informs much of the way I now work and will be referred to a lot on this podcast. In fact, so much so that I am explaining it in detail over a few episodes. This is the third of three overview episodes that provide an understanding of how it was designed. In this third episode, I will explain the behaviors I saw exhibited when children were in interaction with a therapy dog. And I'll explain why I selected to score for those behaviors. I will also give a summary of some highlights from the study at the end and share some important facets that made me realize how continuing to study in this way is so needed. At the end of the last episode, I explained the assessments that influenced my study design and also how I selected an assessment with which to compare the results I found. But how to organize the results I found? I ended up creating a behavior checklist, which simply means I selected behaviors, watched the videos, and scored each time I saw a participant do one of the behaviors toward Maddie, the therapy dog. As I mentioned at the end of the last episode, the behaviors that were identified in my study were categorized into two broad categories entitled approach and retreat, which is broadly based on how the strange situation categorizes behaviors. This might be a little tedious, but I would like to go over each of the behaviors briefly. Then, as I have mentioned, many of them will show up in a lot more detail as additional specific podcast episodes. So the behavior checklist has two categories then, approach and retreat. I'll start by explaining the approach behaviors, and then I will explain the retreat behaviors. In the approach category are the following behaviors: when the participant made sustained eye contact, when they initiated touch — this is all toward Maddie — when they initiated touch toward Maddie, when they initiated verbalization or talking to her, when they represented her in their play or other stories, when they initiated a smile toward her, when they made a physical approach toward her, when they talked about her in a positive projection, when they talked about her in the same way as themselves, when they made mirroring behaviors or movements of her, and when they were just generally curious about her. Each of these behaviors is explained now as follows. Sustained eye contact is the first behavior, and I define that as eye contact that lasted for a period of 3 seconds between the participant and Maddie. The behavior of making eye contact is found widely in many areas of psychological import. For example, the polyvagal theory has illustrated a brain-face-heart circuit that explains features of mental health. And eye contact is one facial feature that was studied easily in a research project such as this. Additionally, there is a quality of being beheld in another's gaze that is readily explored in literature on the development of self. D.W. Winnicott, mentioned earlier, discusses this, as does Jacques Lacan, a French psychoanalyst and psychiatrist. And I also chose eye contact because of its relationship to the latter category of mirroring, which I will discuss in a minute. Certainly, eye contact establishes a foundational piece of the necessary function of feeling mirrored by another. That is, for one to be mirrored, one must be seen by the other. So it was important to add in as a category both to investigate how the child participants were able to behold the therapy dog and also how their eye contact maybe bids for a reciprocal behavior. In other words, to see if they were requesting to be beheld by the therapy dog. It seemed to me that the behavior needed to be sustained eye contact in order for it to be meaningful in these ways. And a length of 3 seconds was an interval that seemed appropriate. It may not at first seem intuitive that a child might bid for the eye contact of the therapy dog. However, my own experiences with my dogs and how others interacted with them over the years, as well as my experiences in seeing clients bid for the eye contact of horses in equine-assisted psychotherapy programs, suggested to me the importance of this behavior. The next behavior was participant-initiated touch. So the child initiates a hug or petting of the therapy dog. This category is mostly included because it is a rather obvious behavior a child would display when signaling a desire to be close to and either establish or maintain a connection with the therapy dog. Additionally, one of the expected behaviors of an infant that would be classified as securely attached in the strange situation experiment is that if the infant became upset during the separation from its caregiver, then upon reunion, that infant would seek contact with the caregiver. This is further explained in the Handbook of Attachment Theory and Research in Clinical Applications by Solomon and George, and we'll have more information on our website. Participant-initiated verbalizations. The child initiates speaking directly to Maddie, such as sharing information about toys. This category is in part included because of the behaviors of one of the first participants who did just that. He continually showed toys to Maddie and attempted to direct her attention toward his play with the toys. Additionally, as before, it is one of the expected behaviors of an infant that would be classified as securely attached in the strange situation. Upon reunion with its caregiver, that a securely attached infant will make vocalizations toward the caregiver. The next category is participant representations, and I define that as the child initiating a drawing of Maddie or that Maddie was represented in the child's play. This category also was established mainly as a result of the behaviors of one of the first participants, who had an elaborate play scene where she narrated how Maddie was interacting with play figures. Additionally, from Solomon and George, a child's linguistic or play behavior is one way to measure attachment. And Mary Main said, quote, children's discourse, representations, and fantasies have been found significantly related to early attachment to the mother. She said this in a 1993 article in the Journal of the American Psychoanalytic Association. The next category is one of my favorites, and that is participant-initiated smiles. When the participant smiles at the therapy dog. Again, this category seemed intuitively obvious to include. Also, as before, one of the expected behaviors of an infant that would be classified as securely attached in the strange situation is that upon reunion, that infant will smile at its caregiver. Additionally, similar to eye contact in reference to the brain-face-heart circuit of the polyvagal theory, this is a second facial feature that is accessible to study. The next category is participant approach. The child physically approaches the therapy dog, including playing with her. While this category shares the name of the overarching approach categorization, I intended it to be a physical approach toward Maddie and could not come up with a more clear statement of that behavior than this same name. The behavior of moving physically closer is important, and I quoted Simpson here. Attachment behaviors include any action that increase proximity between children and their attachment figures, which is also from the Handbook of Attachment that I mentioned earlier, this time by Simpson. Participant-initiated positive projections. The child identifies a strength or pleasing characteristic of the therapy dog. The intuitive part of this category choice is based on my experience of watching others interact with my golden retrievers and knowing that sometimes upon meeting them, new people identified characteristics about them that could not have been known at the time, or in some cases were not even true. Also, this category choice comes from my therapy work with children and observing that often children communicate about their feelings by mentioning a classmate or sibling who has similar feelings to their own. So I wondered if this might occur with a therapy dog. Additionally, as you might remember from the first podcast episode, Nancy McWilliams defined projection as the process whereby what is inside is misunderstood as coming from outside. In its benign and mature forms, it is the basis for empathy. So with this study's interest in empathy, this was an important category to include. Also, since participants could not speak directly with the therapy dog, I wanted to observe how they might use projections in an attempt to make sense of her world, which, as McWilliams further described, we must use our capacity to project our own experience in order to understand someone else's subjective world. The next behavior I called sameness discourse. It's when a child identifies things that are the same between themselves and the therapy dog. Again, this is a mostly intuitive category choice. While this behavior is similar to projections, I intended it to be a special case where the participant extended the characteristics of the dog to be a match of a characteristic with herself or himself. There are lots of fun examples of this, but for now, to illustrate, Maddie's eye color or being the younger sister were things that participants picked up on as being, quote, just like me. So that's why I called it same discourse. It was a lot of, Maddie has this just like me. Oh, Maddie's that just like me. When it came up in that way where it was very specific that the participants were calling out that she was just like them is when I coded for sameness discourse. Mirroring movements. I define this to be where the child mirrored the body positions or motions of the therapy dog. It is theorized that we each have mirror neurons that function to simulate the experience of another for us in our own brains. I learned about this through Marco Iacoboni's work in 2008, and also Jacques Lacan wrote about it in 1949. Lacan discussed it as an important stage of development that he called the mirror stage, which contributed to the choice of this category. I was curious if and how these concepts might extend into the therapy session and if the participant might physically mirror the therapy dog, and they did. And what I didn't anticipate is that Maddie mirrored them back, body positions and other movements of the participants too. Investigation and exploration. The child makes a healthy inquiry about features of the therapy dog. This category was added after sessions had occurred with a few participants, and I realized that it is a unique behavior for a child to be interested in learning about another, dependent perhaps in part on age and history. In a 10-year psychoanalytic longitudinal study of mothers and children, Brody, Axelrod, and Moreau, different spelling to my last name, found, quote, interest in mother is a sign of favorable development as children mature. This was published in the International Review of Psychoanalysis in 1976. So you'll hear me say it at the end of this, but we need a lot more research in these areas. But for now, let's summarize. The behaviors in the approach category are sustained eye contact, participant-initiated touch, participant-initiated verbalizations, participant representations, participant-initiated smiles, participant approach, participant-initiated positive projections, sameness discourse, mirroring movements, and investigation and exploration. The second major category in the behavior checklist is the retreat category. As I mentioned earlier, there is academic support for movements toward to be conceptualized as attachment behaviors. And for balance, it seems necessary to have a category of behaviors that describe movements away or in retreat. There is academic support that shows withdrawal as an unfavorable development in the same longitudinal study mentioned above by Brody and all. Yet, as Bowlby explained in 1982 in the second edition of his book Attachment and Loss, withdrawal behavior is also developmentally appropriate and sometimes necessary. As a researcher, I do not necessarily ascribe a consistent quality of detachment, unfavorable or otherwise, to retreat movements. Additionally, in my own experience, I have seen clients actually need to develop the ability to retreat. There is now a diagnosis category for children who exhibit what's called disinhibited social engagement. And children meet criteria for this diagnosis in a variety of ways that include the assessment of whether or not there has been social neglect, repeated changes in their primary caregivers, or growing up in environments that limit the ability to make strong bonds. In other words, if the child cannot respect personal space and boundaries, it is a concerning sign, at least if it's chronic. And so conversely, if the participants in the study could moderate personal space and retreat from the therapy dog as they needed, that could be a healthy sign. In the retreat category of the behavioral checklist are the following. Participant retreats. Participant's subtle refusal of contact. Participant's obvious refusal of contact. Participant initiated negative projections and repeated inquiries. Each of these behaviors is explained now as follows. Participant retreats, where the child physically retreats from the therapy dog. As before, even though this category bears the same name as the larger category, to me it was necessary to have a category that counted physical movements away from Maddie. As I mentioned earlier, Maddie stayed on a blanket while she was working, so children had lots of opportunities to move to another area of the room that was out of range of the blanket. Then there was a category that I called participants' subtle refusal of contact. That is, looking away, moving away slightly, or a discontinuation of petting. This category is modeled on the behaviors of infants in the insecure avoidant group in the strained situation, who upon reunion with their mother respond by turning away, looking away, and suddenly refusing contact, and by paying attention to toys or the environment instead of their mother. This is mentioned in the 1993 article I stated earlier that Mary Main wrote in the Journal of the American Psychoanalytic Association. And then I placed a category of participants' obvious refusal of contact, and that was when the child requested to leave the room or verbally refused to interact with Maddie. This category exists because of the behaviors of the first participant, whom, to my surprise, refused contact with the therapy dog for an entire session. This was a surprise because, as I mentioned, myself, the therapist, and guardians did a lot of work in advance to ensure the participant wanted to participate in this project. This ended up being extremely rare, as I had originally suspected, and in the future may warrant inclusion of an exceptions category, but for purposes of this research, is counted as its own category. Then I listed the category of participant initiative negative projections, where the child identified a weakness or displeasing characteristic of the therapy dog. To balance the category of positive projections, I added this contrasting negative projections category. McWilliams said projections are problematic when the projected attitudes seriously distort the object on whom they are projected, or when what is projected consists of disowned and highly negative parts of the self. For all of these citations, we will have links on our website, connectiontherapypodcast.com. Then there is a category that I entitled repeated inquiries, where the child shows an unhealthy obsession or like a rumination over characteristics of the therapy dog. I included this category because of the behaviors exhibited by two participants. One participant displayed obsessive behaviors of pulling the therapy dog's tail and leash, and another participant asked repeated questions about her hair and grooming behaviors. I hesitated to put the second participant's behavior in this retreat category because they ended up having a positive effect for her, which I will explain in a later episode. I decided to place them in this category because the feeling quality of the repeated questions, that is, the feeling I had when she continued to ask them, was a vacancy of memory of the things we discussed previously, which to me was more of a withdrawal than an approach. So the behavior checklist was the way I designed to measure what happened in the sessions. I also had to define my hypotheses and state what I thought they would be. I had three research hypotheses, or three things I set forth at the beginning of the study, that I sort of had to claim based on my review and understanding of the literature and the relevant theories and things I mentioned earlier. Then, when you do the study, you kind of test whether or not those things happen. The research hypotheses I designed were as follows. Number one, the first was that there would be a change in the behaviors for the participants. I hypothesized that I would see a change in approach behaviors of the participants over the course of the four sessions as measured by the behavior checklist. Research hypothesis two. Secondly, I hypothesized that experiencing animal-assisted therapy interventions would increase attachment-related behaviors as measured by the relationship skills subscale on the Devereaux Student Strengths Assessment that I mentioned earlier. And for number three, well, lastly, I hypothesized that there would be a correlation between participants who scored high on approach behaviors in the behavior checklist and participants who scored high pre-test, post-test, or both on the DESA relationship subscales. Note here that there was a pre-assessment that was given to the guardians before the session started, and then they were given a post-assessment after sessions were completed. And a correlation is a statistic that measures if there is a relationship between two variables. So what this was testing was if the measurements on the DESA and the behavioral checklist were similar. Like if participants had a high score on one assessment, then they would also have a high score on the second assessment. The first two hypotheses were designed to be participant-specific, and the third was more of an overall summation. For the first research hypothesis that there would be a change in their approach behaviors over the course of the four sessions, for some participants, this did happen. However, it probably wasn't what you're expecting. At least, it wasn't what I was expecting on the whole. For some participants, the approach behaviors did increase, which I did think would happen. Maddie was a lovely dog. I just thought everyone would want to be closer to her as they got to know her over the course of the sessions. However, some participants reduced their approach behaviors over time, and for some, it was session dependent and kind of an unpredictable pattern that was sometimes high and sometimes low in terms of how much they approached her, which resulted in a flat trend across the sessions by the time you average them out. I'll go through all the hypotheses before I comment on what I think they mean. The second hypothesis, as a reminder, was that experiencing the four animal-assisted therapy sessions would result in an increase in attachment behaviors as measured by the relationship subscale on the DESA, and this did not occur in a way that was statistically significant. The third hypothesis was that there would be a correlation between the two assessments, the behavioral checklist and the DESA, and this did not happen. There was not a correlation between the assessments. So, what happened? As far as what happened on an individual basis in the approach category, a couple things have stuck with me as I've reflected on this over the years since the study. I have started to conceptualize the approach and retreat behaviors as a kind of unique attachment pattern for each participant. For example, the children who exhibited approach behaviors in an unpredictable pattern, some high and some low, happened to be raised in similar environments, where caregivers in the home environment were likewise unpredictable. Furthermore, many of these children had experienced sudden and traumatic losses of family members, and it is common for children and adults to do what is called a premature foreclosure and withdraw from a relationship before it is fully concluded, to sort of jump to the part where the separation occurs as the anticipation of waiting for it to naturally occur can be unbearable. All of the participants knew that at the end of the four sessions, the animal-assisted therapy interventions would conclude. So it seems possible that at least a couple wanted to rush that along by not interacting as much in the final sessions. Lastly, as I mentioned, for some children, it is a healthy stance to recognize appropriate personal boundaries. So not always would a decrease in approach behaviors be counterproductive. It may be a healthy move, in fact. You might be wondering if it is natural for me to have lots of good reasons why my hypotheses didn't work out, and I acknowledge that is true. But at the same time, you'll see in the episodes focused on the specific behaviors, there was enough information gathered in the ways the participants displayed behaviors that makes me think something about this is highly effective. I just think I wasn't yet measuring it to the level of complexity required. For the second and third hypotheses, my belief is that these weren't found because the assessments were measuring different things. Remember I mentioned about the idea of a construct and that it is the essence of what it is you are measuring. For the behavior checklist and the DESA, I am confident that what I picked up on in my study was not the same content as what the DESA picks up on. Some of the participants did have interesting profiles when you look at the behavior trends over the four sessions, especially in light of their development and trauma histories. So I am interested in learning if perhaps the behaviors displayed are diagnostic in a way that reveals their internal dynamics while in relationship. Furthermore, the information for the DESA is reported by caregiver or teacher. And while I believe that self-report and caregiver-reported measurements are important, they also have a layer of interpretation based on the perspective of the one scoring the report. That does not reflect what I am interested in studying. Most of what I discussed earlier in the introduction of the study was about how much of what I am interested in studying in relationships is not at the level of conscious awareness. By definition, then, it cannot be picked up in an assessment that is self-reported or caregiver-reported. As I mentioned, there will be additional episodes about the behaviors, so for now I'll make some closing general statements. As it was a first step, this study has many limitations. One of the big limitations is the scope of it. The results are from only 9 participants and with only 1 researcher, so it is difficult to make broad statements, and the statements that are made are primarily from only my perspective. Though I did consult with my faculty for the research and with the treating therapist for the participants, especially when I had questions about the behaviors I was seeing. Yet, given its limitations, I still learned so many things that I was not expecting to learn. My experiences with this project are what makes me now have a new additional research interest. And that is, not only can the behaviors the humans display be diagnostic, but so too can the behaviors the animal display be diagnostic. I have since that time worked more in the field of equine-assisted therapy and realized how, much like humans, animals have their own uniqueness. Some are well-suited to be working in therapy and some affinitized toward different humans more than others. So this project helped me understand that there is something happening and I would like to learn more about it. Watching the videos of Maddie working during this project, I realized what a natural therapy dog she was. I mentioned in another podcast episode that I had 2 golden retrievers. Maddie's older sister, Gage, was interested in people, of course. She was a golden, but not like Maddie. Maddie was observant. I used to joke and call her my ambassador because whenever there were new people, say at the house to visit or something, she had a knack for picking out the one who looked the most uncomfortable and walking up to include them in the gathering. You know how animals do, where they just sort of give so much attention to the shy person that they are naturally drawn into the group. She also seemed to have an awareness of herself. Once, a family with young children moved in next door to where we lived. The fence between us was a standard chain link, so the kids could pet the dogs through the fence. Both Maddie and Gage were younger at the time, and they had a lot of energy. The kids were scared at first because, as you can imagine, Gage and Maddie were essentially bouncing all over the place to get closer to them. It was a healthy concern because Maddie and Gage each weighed about 80 pounds. They were respectful and didn't push on the fence, but they wanted to smell and touch the kids too. After a couple weeks, Maddie seemed to be aware of the children's trepidation. She seemed to notice that the children were concerned about hers and Gage's teeth. Again, a healthy speculation on the part of the kids. And without prompting, she began backing into the fence. She figured out that they liked her soft hair, so she would approach by backing up to them and allowing them to pet her. Then, as they were more comfortable, she slowly brought her face around. This is something I wouldn't have even known how to ask her to do. So it was all her making. And as I say, this is something I observed about her and happened years before she actually worked as a therapy dog. So you can imagine from that one example, and there are many, that her skills were just natural. And I realized that more and more as I watched the videos of her. There was the work with one participant in particular that has changed the way I see this phenomena of asking animals to work with us in a therapeutic setting. It happened with one of the participants who was sexually abused. The perpetrator was her grandmother's boyfriend, and it was chronic abuse, meaning it happened repeatedly before anyone realized and could stop it. Victims in this situation develop an incredible ability to mask their anxiety. It is really difficult to see it, especially as new to the field like I was. However, when we started working with her, Maddie knew immediately. In those videos, Maddie can be seen displaying anxious behaviors herself. She wouldn't settle on the blanket like normal, and we had been doing a few sessions by this point, so that was unusual. And she was trying to communicate with me by pawing my leg. She almost never did that, so I should have paid more attention to her. Instead, I was so nervous. As a new researcher and invited to the nonprofit agency, I was so hyper-focused on us doing a, quote, good job that I told Maddie no. I didn't really scold her in front of the participant, but my meaning was clear and she knew I did not want her to continue pawing me. Of course, I was saddened to see it on video because I finally, once I watched with the sound off, I finally noticed as it became extremely clear how nervous everyone in the room was. With the sound off, you can't hear all the polite statements that people use to cover up their internal feelings. So it was really evident. In hindsight, I believe Maddie picked up on the anxiety the child felt right away, and likely so too did myself and her treating therapist. Unfortunately, I did what a lot of humans do, and I brushed aside Maddie's communications as well as any I may have been sensing myself. In other words, you can see the tenseness in my body and my own actions display anxiety, but it was unconscious to me at that point. This experience and others in the study are among the paramount ways it affected my understanding of psychology. Something was happening and it moved across all beings in the room. I couldn't see it while it was happening because I was too focused on whatever it was I thought I was supposed to be doing and saying. But Maddie knew. And this is what informs a lot of how I now work and am continuing to study. There are so many implications to this realization. Some of them include what and how was moving through the room. As we've discussed, the polyvagal theory suggests our nervous systems are impacted by other people, animals, and our environment. But up until that point, I didn't realize how real-time that could be. I've seen something similar happen with horses working in therapy too. And here is one more significant implication to consider. The animals we ask to accompany us in the therapeutic environment do experience things, and we are not fully certain what or how. In fact, we are not even certain for ourselves either. So this, to me, means we need to start understanding this phenomena much, much better. In my experience, our animal counterparts can provide assessments of the patients in session. Well, let me qualify that. Our animal counterparts display behaviors that reflect whatever it is that's happening. And so, working with animals must be part of our interest in researching this area more. But that isn't all. Animals are always able to sense their environment. For that matter, humans are too. As I mentioned, Maddie figured this out as a very young dog. So this has to be an innate characteristic and not a learned one. So these are among some of the many reasons I am so focused on understanding this phenomena better. There are many more interesting stories to share about this project, and I will include them in the episodes focused on those behaviors. I should mention again, in case you didn't hear the first episode, that sadly Maddie passed away shortly after the study concluded. I didn't expect it, and I took it really hard. That was something else I learned about as part of the study. Maddie was honored at the nonprofit agency where we did the study, and so any participants that were still clients there learned of her passing. The treating therapists at this site are very well skilled, and they worked with her loss in session, as so many of the clients had experienced losses. This was a way for them to mourn their friend Maddie, as well as their loved ones, with the support of their therapists. It was an unexpected part of their treatment, and for me, an unexpected welcome gift to realize how many people she had touched. As is true for many, maybe all, research studies, I did not know at the time exactly how that study would influence the way I now practice. And I continue to learn and am doing more research. So I will continually be updating Connection Therapy podcasts, and ideally we will have guests bring their expertise as well. So there's lots more to come. This study helped me understand a lot of how I now see the world. The observation of behaviors changed how I view others and myself, and I am continually curious about the many ways we are always communicating with one another through our mostly nonverbal behaviors. Doing this study enhanced the way I practice, and I'll share this with you in our episodes about clinical skills, in the hopes of helping you tie the information to your practice as you see fit. As I mentioned, more research needs to be done in this area. One of the quotes that was motivating me during my study and continues to be now is from a 2009 article in The Healing Power of Emotion, Effective Neuroscience Development and Clinical Practice, from Jaak Panksepp, who was an Estonian-American neuroscientist and psychobiologist who happened to coin that term, effective neuroscience, which you'll hear us talk about a lot on the podcast. But for now, I will summarize by reading his quote, and it goes like this. While psychotherapy must obviously continue to deal realistically with individual lived lives, we are finally entering an era where evidence-based, effective views on the mammalian brain can provide an understanding of cross-mammalian, universal, effective emotional processes that may provide a scientific foundation for new, effective, and body-oriented therapies. He's able to summarize in one paragraph what I just took nearly 3 hours to say, and that is, something is happening across all beings that can be felt. That effective view means in that emotional states are moving across the room, much like I experienced. And they may be able to provide an understanding of what happens across species in a universal way that could help identify new therapies that support both emotional and body concerns. It's a very exciting time to be in the field, and I'm so glad you're listening to this podcast and that we can walk on this journey together. Thank you so much. I hope you'll join us again for future explorations in the field of psychology. If you would like to learn more about the authors and the studies listed in this episode, you'll find more information about them on our website, connectiontherapypodcast.com. And if you'd like to take a step further, we offer additional ways you can collaborate with us. Maybe you would like to confidentially discuss a case or do some additional consulting. We'd be happy to speak with you. We also have study groups where you have the opportunity to join and gain more knowledge in a supportive environment. These are small groups where we share and explore the podcast topics and more in detail. And in some states, your time spent in the group may be able to qualify toward your continuing education requirements for many licensure types. You will find more information on our website, connectiontherapypodcast.com. Thanks. Until next time.